The creators of the hydrogen bomb tapped into the vastest source of energy in our solar system, fusion, the same phenomenon that makes the sun shine. In Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking, Charles Seif explores mankind's many brilliant and sometimes foolish attempts to harness the power of the sun. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Seif, an associate professor of journalism at NYU and a winner of the Penn Martha Albrand Award for Nonfiction, to the show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You begin the book with the famous radium discovery of Pierre and Marie Curie. How did their work begin our pursuit of fusion energy?
Well, they uncovered a mystery. For a long time, scientists realized that you couldn't really create energy out of nothing, that every source of energy had to have an ultimate reason, an ultimate source. And radium was a seemingly a source of power without a reason. That it wasn't an electric source of power, it wasn't a magnetic source of power. It was just producing energy without any real reason to be. You put it in a chunk of ice, and the ice would just melt. And you could keep freezing the ice, and it would keep melting. So that energy had to come from somewhere. It turned out, they didn't know this at the time, that the energy was from the breakdown of matter itself, the conversion of matter into energy.
But that's nuclear fission, isn't it?
That's correct.
So, and the nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki employed nuclear fission. What's the difference between nuclear fission and nuclear fusion?
The two processes
other than a couple of vowels.
Yes. They're really two sides of the same coin. Everything has iron envy in some sense. Every element wants to be iron. And if you can try to get it closer to iron in some sense, like light elements combining together to become iron.
I-R-O-N?
I-R-O-N. It's ironic. And heavy elements breaking apart, if you get them closer to iron in size, you release energy. And you release it because some of the tiny little bit of matter in the atom is converted via the equation E equals MC squared into an enormous amount of energy. So fission, the stuff of the first atom bombs, the stuff that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was fission. Big atoms breaking apart, becoming more like iron and releasing energy. Later on, Edward Teller and a number of other scientists figured out that you can get even more energy by sticking together light elements like hydrogen to get them more like iron. It's a much more powerful reaction, but it's hard to get started.
And is it also an employment of E equals MC squared?
It is. It is indeed. If you add up the masses of the hydrogens you start with and look at the helium that you get out of a fission reaction, out of a fusion reaction, you'll see that the helium weighs a little bit less than the hydrogen components that go into it.
Did the successful development of the atomic bomb inspire people like Teller to search for a way to harness nuclear fusion?
Indeed. In fact, Teller was trying to harness fusion long before the fission bomb was actually created. Back in Los Alamos, when this tremendous group of scientists was trying to end the war with this fission device, Teller wasn't so interested in working with uranium and plutonium. In his mind, that wasn't a terribly interesting problem to solve. He was trying to get hydrogen bombs, which in theory are tens or thousands or even hundreds of thousands times more powerful than the bombs that were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Now, the fission bombs rely on radioactive materials, but hydrogen isn't radioactive.
That's true, that in theory, if you get a fusion reaction working, that you don't need radioactive materials, and it produces no radioactive wastes, at least in theory. Helium is a light gas that isn't radioactive. You release it, and it actually will float off into space after a while. The Earth's gravity isn't strong enough to hold it. So one of the real allures of fusion energy is that you don't need fissile material to get it started, and it really doesn't produce waste that we have to worry about.
So the places where the hydrogen bombs were tested were safe for human habitation?
Well, theory and practice are a little different.
Because if I remember correctly, if there is anything left of Bikini Atoll, it's not safe.
Yeah, they had to evacuate the residents of nearby islands. The problem is that when you have a fusion reaction, it produces neutrons. Neutrons are subatomic particles that, when they strike other atoms, often cause them to become radioactive. So a hydrogen bomb goes off, even though in theory it doesn't really produce much waste on its own, it irradiates everything around it, including the sand and water, which shoot up into the air and rain down as fallout. And in the 1950s and 1960s, scientists began to realize that, in fact, fusion bomb tests in the atmosphere were irradiating the world. And doctors were detecting an increase in radioactive strontium in baby bones and baby teeth. There was a brief project where people were trying to figure out how to do body snatching to figure out whether the strontium levels were actually a threat to mankind.
Well, the first hydrogen bomb was exploded in 1952. That's during the Eisenhower administration. And I remember that there was talk about harnessing all of this in a thing called Project Plowshares. Would they have been using the fission or the fusion bombs to do that?
Pardon me. They would have been using fusion bombs. Pardon me, I've got a terrible cold. They would have used fusion bombs because those are so powerful. They can move enormous volumes of land at one time.
So they were talking about actually building canals, for example, by using fusion bombs. But from what you just said, you could build a canal, but nobody could ever go through it because it would be radioactive for a very long period.
That's correct. I
mean, is that what happened? Is that what people suddenly realized that it wasn't a good idea?
People did realize it took many years to figure this out. But the projects went on until the late 60s, early 70s, where they had these grandiose plans. Build lakes, turn on gas wells, turn off gas wells, build new canals. But the radioactivity problem made it impractical to have working fusion bombs in the open atmosphere because it would irradiate things.
But couldn't we just do fusion on a much smaller scale and cut down on the radiation aspect?
Well, that's
we're talking about huge bombs that are how many times more powerful than the atomic bomb?
Thousands. In theory, pardon me, if you're going to move Earth, you want to do it with a big bang. So there's no point in going small. If you want to harness fusion on a smaller scale, you have to get rid of your bomb-sized ideas and your Earth-moving schemes.
But I could see fusion, since fusion is the way the sun produces energy. I could see fusion as something that we might want to employ to create electricity, for example. And that sounds like a much better idea than what we've been doing with our nuclear power plants.
Oh, absolutely. If you could get fusion reaction in a tabletop, a miniature sun in a bottle, you basically have a sun at your whim. It produces infinite energy with very little waste and very little radiation.
Is this what leads you to your subtitle here, wishful thinking?
That's right. Since the 1950s, since the first atom bomb, since the first hydrogen bomb, even before that, scientists thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could get this sun in a bottle? But after more than half a century, we are more or less where we started. Initially, the scientists were predicting fusion energy, endless energy at your fingertips, was 20 years away. Now the estimates are 35 to 40 years away. So after half a century, we've gotten 10 years further away from the goal.
Well, in the old days, it seems to me that people were a lot more willing to do things that now seem to us slightly crazy. You write about scientists proposing to blow up the moon. What did they hope to achieve by doing that?
Oh, yeah. That was one of Edward Teller's more fun plans.
Why he's Dr. Strangelovian in so many people's minds?
He is. Some of his ideas were genuinely Strangelovian. In fact, he thought at one point that the mutations caused by radiation from hydrogen bombs might be a good thing. We might become superhumans. But his moon blowing up idea, he said it would be irresistible to shoot at the moon. And actually, before the moon landings, before we can get a sample, if you blew up a chunk of the moon with a hydrogen bomb, you'd actually get a lot of information about what the moon was made of. You'd have X-rays irradiating the material of the moon, and ground-based astronomers could figure out what the material of the moon was. But of course,
couldn't you also blow it out of its orbit? It's not all that heavy.
Yes. Well, it would take a lot more than hydrogen bombs to do it, but you could probably make it a fine layer of dust in orbit if you wanted to. I think Teller would have enjoyed that, but I think very few other people would have signed on to that project.
My guest is Charles Seife, S-E-I-F-E. His latest book, Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking, published by Viking. What is cold fusion?
Well, cold fusion is a technique that people thought could create a fusion reaction without resorting to the high temperatures that are required to get these atoms to stick together.
And I remember the New York Times running a front page article about these two scientists. Was it Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons?
That's correct.
Utah somewhere?
University of Utah. The two of them in 1989 had announced at a press conference that they had solved this problem that had been plaguing physicists for years. And in a little hunk of metal that they could hold in their hand, they were creating energy out of basically nothing. And if correct, it would have basically put all the gas companies out of business, that you'd have a power plant the size of a coffee can. It's a Mr. Fusion out of Back to the Future. The problem was that a fusion reaction causes neutrons, and they weren't detecting neutrons. If they were getting energy, the amounts that they were claiming, the coffee can would have been so radioactive it would have killed everyone in the room. So physicists in the know about fusion were immediately skeptical that Pons and Fleischmann actually had what they were saying.
And do you think that Pons and Fleischmann were sincere in what they thought they had achieved, or were they pulling off some kind of scam? And if they were pulling off some kind of scam, what did they think they were going to get away with ultimately?
I think they started off sincere. I think that they thought they had a big discovery in hand, and before they turned it out to their peers who had criticized more or less behind the scenes, they put it to the public and made a big splash. And then I think when they realized that things were falling apart, they had a very difficult moment to eat crow in front of billions of people and recant, or to press forward they still had a bunch of supporters and a bunch of funders who were willing to give the money and press forward and hope against hope that they were correct. And I think they chose the latter course. And they took money from Japanese firms. They went to France and did cold fusion research for a number of years before quietly ending research on the project.
What's happened to them? Are their careers totally destroyed?
Well, they're certainly associated with the biggest scientific scandal of the 20th century. I tried to track them down for my book, and I was unable to contact either of them. Fleischmann, as far as I know, is still in England. Pons left the University of Utah quietly in 1990, went to France, and I wrote to every Pons in France hoping to reach him and never managed to find him.
Well, if you had, that would have been a great Ponzi scheme, wouldn't it? Oh, that's another kind of a scandal. Is part of the problem in researching something like this that there's so much secrecy surrounding it, especially when the government gets involved?
Yes. One particular fusion scheme, laser fusion, is largely shrouded by this veil of secrecy because it is involved with weapons research. That is, there's a facility out in California known as NIF, and it is designed to simulate the inside of a hydrogen bomb. And for that reason, the government doesn't let anyone look at the research. But the problem is, outside researchers have a strong suspicion that the big project, which costs $4 billion plus, is not performing the way it should. And with that veil of secrecy, it's hard for outsiders to penetrate and see whether, in fact, the claims are real or they're just fiction.
Well, what is to be achieved by recreating the inside of a hydrogen bomb?
That's a good question. Initially, if you speak to the scientists at NIF, they say that this is an energy project, that what they do is they shoot lasers at a tiny pellet of hydrogen, and by using those lasers to heat and compress this hydrogen, it makes a miniature sun. And in theory, if you got this process efficient enough, you could produce energy. The problem is the NIF laser is not efficient enough by a long stretch to produce energy.
So we can actually produce energy in theory, but it would cost us more money, more to produce it than we would save. This sounds like so many of our energy developing schemes.
That's right. That's right. An energy sucking device is of no use to anyone. And all the fusion devices, short of a hydrogen bomb, all fusion devices now are energy sucking devices. And they're trying to figure out how to produce more energy out than they use, consume to start the reaction. And so, that's a very hard project.
So how realistic is the possibility of harnessing fusion energy for peaceful uses?
Well, I have a wager going, $1,000, that we won't have a working power plant by 2050. And no one has taken me up on that yet. I do think it's possible. I think it's certainly within the realm of possibility. And I think it's more than even odds if we look at the year 2500 that our society may well be fusion powered. But the problem is that all the research to date has been largely wishful thinking, that they keep thinking that they're going to get this energy out, and yet all of these problems surface that prevent, that suck energy in. And so after 60 years of it's 20 years away, it's 20 years away, it's 20 years away, I think we have to take a look back and see what's going wrong. Are we deluding ourselves, or is this really a project that can work?
Would an international project be a better approach?
That's the big hope, and that's why a big project in the south of France to the tune of $10, $15, $20 billion, no one knows the price tag yet, is underway.
But that's ITER, International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor?
That's right, and some say what it's really eating is money. ITER is going to be online in 2018, and its proponents say that it will produce more energy by a factor of 10 than it sucks in. However, if you look at the accounting sheet, it's really close to break even if it works perfectly, and it's not going to put anything on the grid. So ITER may actually break the jinx of fusion devices that don't produce more energy than they consume, but I think it's still quite a distance away from a practical fusion power plant.
Well, you have to do one before you get to the other, don't you? This problem seems to be a lot harder to solve than anybody imagined.
Absolutely. The first magnetic fusion devices in the 1950s, they thought they were really, really close. They thought it was just a simple idea. You just put a burning hydrogen hot cloud of gas in a magnetic field, and voila, fusion.
And there's so much hydrogen around, it's the most common of all the gases.
It's the most common of all elements in the universe. You take seawater, you put electricity in, you get hydrogen out. And if you got fusion working, it would be a fuel that's more abundant than anything. The problem is nature seems to resist doing fusion in a simple way, that every time you manage to compress a gas of hydrogen, it squirts out in different directions. There's different things called instabilities that actually prevent a hot gas cloud from getting compressed properly.
What about magnetic fusion?
Magnetic fusion is probably the most promising method, and ITER, the big international project, is a magnetic fusion device. What it does is it uses a hot cloud of hydrogen actually feels magnetic field lines, like a refrigerator feels a magnet, and you can control and compress it with magnetic fields. The problem is, every time you do that, there are the cloud kinks and writhes and tries to get out of control. And the history of magnetic fusion has essentially been scientists trying to figure out how to wrestle with a cloud of gas. And they're getting very good at it. They're getting it to the point where it's tens of millions of degrees, and they're confining it for tens of seconds at a time. But it's not enough yet.
Now, this uses hydrogen, and we've been hearing about the future of automobiles, hydrogen-fueled cars. We're talking about two totally different technologies?
Yes, there's actually a little different bob and weave when it comes to the hydrogen economy. In theory, if hydrogen is a really good way of storing energy, if you burn it, it becomes water. It's very clean. So you either put it in a fuel cell or you burn it directly in a car, and it's pollution-free. The problem is you need energy to produce the hydrogen. You need to put electricity into water to crack it, or you have to strip hydrogen off a methane molecule. So in itself, hydrogen is not a source of energy unless you fuse it. getting the hydrogen costs energy. And so like fusion devices, a hydrogen fuel cell needs to, you need to put energy in to get it to work.
Since this has been so difficult in the past, you think that future governments like the incoming administration in Washington will be more reluctant to put money into these kinds of projects?
I think that with the current economic climate, it's going to be harder and harder to find money for research such as ITER. In fact, even before this crisis started, Congress was fighting over whether or not to fund ITER at all. Congress completely zeroed out the budget for ITER. So it's hanging by a thread, at least in the United States. So I do think it's going to be hard, although energy is going to be big on the new administration's profile. John Holdren, who was just named to be the science advisor, is big on energy and big on fusion. I think the short term, they're going to be concentrating on more practical research areas like clean fission.
One of the problems with the nuclear reactors we rely on now is what to do with the waste. Would there be a problem of that sort if we started using fusion energy?
That's one of the dirty secrets of fusion. Fusion advocates like to say it's clean, it produces no waste, but the neutrons are really ugly. And if you've got a cloud of hydrogen fusing in a vessel, the vessel is irradiated with neutrons and it becomes highly radioactive. And this is a waste problem, just like the waste problem of depleted uranium, uranium rods. It's less severe. It's the material decays over hundreds and thousands of years rather than tens of thousands, but it's still there. So I think that as a technological solution, it is not much better than fission. And fission power plants are already here.
Charles Seif, S-E-I-F-E, is the author of Decoding the Universe, Alpha and Omega and Zero, which won the Penn Martha Allbrand Award for First Nonfiction Book, was named a New York Times Notable Book. He's an associate professor of journalism at New York University and has written for quite a few publications. His latest book, Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.